The other Florida is north and west of the tourists in the space age. It is unknown Florida, half the state, but it can be another country and sometimes even another world. This is the story of a journey there, a journey which began from place to place, went on through time, and ended among the people whose home and destiny the other Florida is.
The Other Florida. WFSU-FM presents a series of personal impressions of a little-known area of our country. Its past and present. Its land, people, and some of its music. A picture in words drawn for all America of its last frontier. Gloria Jehoda reads from her book, The Other Florida, an account of her impressions of this unknown country.
It may have been romantic entanglements that were responsible for Delius's leaving Jacksonville. It may only have been restlessness and a desire to see more of America. When a providential call from a Professor Ruckert of Danville, Virginia, appeared in the Florida Daily Times for a music teacher, Fritz answered it. Ruckert, who met him at the Danville Depot, had fiery red hair, a goatee like Uncle Sam, money, and pretty daughters. Anxious to impress Danville with his discovery, he announced the arrival of the celebrated Professor Delius, who would not only teach the Ruckert girls, but all of the Roanoke Female College, a finishing school for young ladies of the Baptist denomination. Fritz had a field day making money and keeping Southern belles enchanted. Virginia Ann Watkins was soon wearing his ring. Willa Giles got an autographed composition. Sue Averett begged for a picture. Dreaming eyes, a trim mustache, dark wavy hair and a Roman nose, the handsomest music master she had ever had. Only Virginia Ann Watkins was jealous of the competition. When her own photograph of Delius turned up many years later, she had torn it in half, but she had pasted it together again. Music was now more than a living. It had become an emotional necessity. Once more, Fritz appealed to Julius, who had hired detectives to find him. Wouldn't Julius reconsider paying for a course in composition at Leipzig? Julius, sick of scenes and alarums, wearily agreed that if Fritz would return to America to teach, he would indeed foot the bill. What else was there to do? Triumphantly in the spring of 1886, Fritz sailed from New York on the Aurania. His time of living in the New World wilderness was, he thought, over. Solano Grove was a green memory, but he would settle on the continent where there were first-rate orchestras and theaters to feed his hunger for them. At Solano, a discouraged Ernest Delius boarded a riverboat and was heard from no more. The vines began to climb higher into the trees. A devastating freeze killed most of the oranges. Elbert and Eliza Anderson stayed on as baffled caretakers. As time went by, Eliza's sister Julia married a Negro named Sanks, who also came to live at Solano. None of them knew what had happened to the young master who had once wanted to hear their music. Still, where else could they go? What the Florida wilderness had done for Delius was not miraculous. It had the effect on him it has had on other artists. It turned him to his own resources. There was nothing to distract him. He was free to become what a later musician called a trained poacher in the wilds of his own soul, a contemplative stirred by nature that was lush and raw. In old age, he loved telling the tallest Florida tales to his friends. He had shot an alligator 21 feet long. He had seen rattlesnakes hypnotize rabbits and then devour them. His English biographers repeat the tales as gospel. An information officer of the Florida Game and Freshwater Fish Commission grins, "I'll bet the gator got longer and the snakes got smarter every time he bragged on 'em." Contemplation stood Delius in good stead during the years in Paris which followed his course at Leipzig. His music went unperformed. When a friend told him that he ought to try tobacco at Solano Grove, he clutched eagerly at the suggestion. Delius, who was soon to drop his baptismal name of Fritz in favor of English Frederick, decided to go to America once more. And if he could find a partner, he would ask Julius to sign over the grove to him outright, on condition that Julius would no longer be responsible for any allowance. Frederick was also uncomfortably deep in a Paris love affair he wanted to be free of. With his friend Halfdan Jebe, a Norwegian violinist whose habits were bohemian and whose conversation was outrageously Rabelaisian, he made the crossing to New York. In the middle of the Atlantic, Frederick and Jebe discovered that the woman Frederick had left Paris to escape had disguised herself as a male passenger and was on board ship. "Here I am," she announced triumphantly. "What are you going to do about it, Fred?" 6 days out of New York, the answer was nothing. Frederick appreciated the joke like a philosopher, and the three travelers made their way down to Jacksonville and then to Solano Grove, where a startled ex-banjo player noted the presence of a woman in the cottage and frowned afterwards, "I don't think they was married." At the shack, Frederick continued work on a piano concerto. Once again, the Andersons and Julia Sanks heard music from dawn into the humid twilight. When Frederick and his companions returned to Europe, he contracted with young Adolf Frohlich and his friend Paul Nicholas of Minden in Westphalia, who agreed to put up £250 each to become half-owners of Solano. At first, their reports were cheerful. Anderson and Sanks were good workers. The place was tangled, but they hoped to clear 30 acres a year. In a few months, the news was grimmer. There had been a storm, wrote Frohlich, the like of which he had never seen. All the tobacco seed beds had been ruined in the deluge of one night. He had ordered fresh seed from Jacksonville, and the second time nothing had come up. It was too hot now to plant anything, and the summer would have to be spent hacking away at the brush. By the following winter, he was writing that Florida was actually far too cold, not too hot. Frederick ought to try to sell the whole wretched place for what he could get. Elbert Anderson thought he could borrow $1,000. This was better than the $500 Charles Douglas had gotten for his own frozen grove. But Frederick refused to sell. The fiasco was all he had to live on. Meanwhile, Europe was finally beginning to hear his music. It would be years before his Florida suite was performed in the concert hall. It had been played once, privately, by an orchestra bribed in a German restaurant with a barrel of beer. Appalachia, the old Indian name for North America, as its composer noted, at first shocked and annoyed critics, later intrigued them, and finally moved them to enthusiasm. Its ultimate fate in Hollywood, where it was tidally harmonized and improved to a fond ballet as the soundtrack for the film The Yearling, was less happy. "Now you not only see the yearling, but you hear him too." When Delius's aunt died, she left him a legacy. In England, as he became more widely known, a young conductor named Thomas Beecham began to use Delius music in almost every concert. The Delius legend gradually took shape. The recluse of Grez-sur-Loing, the home of the woman he married, artist Jelka Rosen, his flight from publicity, hardening in austerity, increasing adulation in a steady stream of newspaper stories in spite of his reticence, the creeping paralysis and finally blindness, and, in 1929, the death-like figure carried into a London auditorium in a wheelchair for the triumphant concerts of a Delius festival, during which nearby streets were thronged by mobs seeking a glimpse of their idol. At the last festival concert, he spoke the only words he ever spoke in public. "Thank you. You have given me the time of my life." Then he returned by ambulance to Grez. He no longer had to worry about Solano Grove. At last his royalties were steady and reliable. "I have seen the best of the earth, and I am content," he said. "Not being able to see does not trouble me. I have my imagination. In Florida, I gradually learned the way in which I should eventually find myself. Contemplation, like composition, cannot be taught." He had, as a matter of fact, given Solano Grove away to the German conductor who had introduced his music to Europe, Dr. Hans Heim. But Heim had no use for it, and in 1914 had quietly turned it over to a relative, Dr. Rudolf Heim, who emigrated to America and then was horrified by his newly acquired jungle, as Delius had been horrified years before. Heim turned over Solano to his attorney and settled in Bradenton on Florida's west coast. One of Delius's friends suggested Solano was a place where writer D.H. Lawrence might recover from tuberculosis. To let him go to Florida would be sending him to disaster, Delius answered. Instead, Lawrence went to disaster in New Mexico. In 1920, a Negro couple named Dude and Mary Brown offered to buy Solano for a turpentine camp, and Heim's attorney was happy to sell. But the attorney hadn't reckoned on Elbert Anderson, who claimed that the right to buy Solano was his, and that Dude and Mary Brown had fraudulently put him out. Dr. Heim found himself being sued by an aggrieved Anderson, who had enlisted the help of a sympathetic St. Augustine law firm, Baldwin and Vetter. Anderson eventually won his case, and Dude Brown had to leave in ignominy. The Andersons tried for 4 years to make a profit on their investment of $574. The Sankses were living on a small farm of their own in nearby Bakersville and were too busy with their own struggle to help. Finally, the aging couple had to sell Solano. They could no longer do the back-breaking work it demanded. Its new owner leased it to some fertilizer companies who thought they could make money on the years of the grove's decay. In 1937, the fertilizer companies went to war. The owner had apparently made unwise commitments. He was sued for damages by the Osceola Fertilizer Company, the Atlantic and Gulf Fertilizer Company, and the Wilson and Toomer Fertilizer Company. He emerged from the courtroom much poorer. By this time, Delius was dead. When a music lover from Jacksonville, Mrs. Henry Richmond, offered to buy Solano for $1,500, it was sold willingly. Later, she deeded it to Jacksonville University. "Surely the spirit of my brother must return often to Solano Grove," said Delius's sister Claire. "He got such inspiration there." But Jacksonville University moved the house to its city campus and restored it. It is flanked on one side by a basketball court, and on the other by an archery range, where suntanned coeds send what look like Cupid's arrows into a row of large, multicolored bull's eyes. What, I wondered, was left at Solano itself? Perhaps if I went down I might find some ancient Negro, but the idea was fantastic. When I stopped to ask directions at the Piccolotta Landing Marina and Harbor Lights Cafe, the shirt-sleeved white owner scratched his head. "Deus? Maybe there's a man by that name down the road. You could ask. I maybe heard of Fred Delius somewhere, but I don't know him personally." I followed the forest-bordered highway 3 miles down the river. When I came to a cluster of shacks opposite a rough path, I stopped the car and parked. Across the road, an old Negro was sitting under a chinaberry tree. His overalls were faded and patched, and his face was heavily seamed under his straw hat. "Solano? Yes'm, you got the wrong place. It's down the road. Turn at the next track." I wanted to ask him what he knew, but I decided any questions would be useless, so I drove away. A Jacksonville University marker soon announced Solano. On a twisted path full of flooded hollows and bordered by thickets of wild scuppernong grapes, I made my way toward the river, splattering my car with mud. After a mile or so, I came to a brick house and drifts of blooming daylilies, red, orange, yellow, and gold. The owner of the lily nursery directed me to a rickety wooden bridge that led deeper into the forest, until I became aware of a strong and unmistakable smell. There, in the shadow of a fallen oak tree with a spread of at least 90 feet, I found 2 smaller trees with glossy leaves and piles of oranges rotting on the ground below. 3 palms stood in front of a clearing the dimensions of a shack. I had come to Solano Grove at last. The dying felled oak was surely Delius's oak. Hurricane Dora had probably toppled it in 1964. The 2 orange trees were what was left of his grove. Pines stirred in damp winds. Pileated woodpeckers flew high in the trees. Here the Andersons and Julia Sanks had sung to Delius long ago. Here the Indians and the Crackers had come to join them to startle European music. I fought my way through briars to the river, where I picked up a piece of the driftwood to take back. I was thinking again, though, of the old Negro under the chinaberry tree up the road. He was still there. "So you found it all right?" His gold teeth flashed at me as he smiled. "I known you would. Did you buy you some lilies? They want lots of water when you get 'em home." "Yes'm." Then he turned his face a little away. "There was a man once. He come to Solano from far off. He was a music maker. And so the white folks taken his house and moved it up to Jacksonville and stood that sign down the road telling what they done." He grinned up at me then. "They ought to have known better, hadn't they? It wasn't the house he cared nothing about. He'd as lief had any kind of roof to lay his bones under. It was the place he set store by. He purely loved the river." "And did you know the music maker?" "No, but I known Elbert Anderson. That was a man worked for him once. Elbert would tell about him. Only one person left now from the Delius times. That was his name, Delius. Julia Sanks, she did for him off and on. She's the oldest old lady in the world, I reckon. Must be near 100. But she's still living over in West Augustine. I couldn't tell you how to get there, but the colored folks that way could help you find her, maybe. Julia, she'd sing to him some when he wanted it." "No'm, I never heard none of his music. But Julia did. He'd play the old piano in the house before he went away, and the squatters cut it up for firewood and sold the keys for ivory." I had nothing to guide me as I started east except the knowledge that southern Negro settlements have few paved roads. A light rain had begun to fall. The highway wound through a darkening turpentine forest where rough trunks were hung with metal boxes. In sight of the water tower of St. Augustine itself, I came to a narrow forest trail. On a hunch, I decided to follow it. The car jogged over chuck holes and through sandy puddles until I reached a collection of shacks, a wooden church, and a cemetery whose scattered graves were decorated by limp bunches of wildflowers. Two old Negro women were walking along a path heedless of the drizzle, their fishing buckets balanced on their heads. I opened the car window. "I was looking for Julia Sanks," I told them. "Yes'm, she on Evergreen Street. You go round and round, and you come to it, sure." But I went round and round, past more shacks and disintegrating Coca-Cola signs, and could find no markers. Under a mimosa tree hung with feathery pink blossoms near a juke joint, a group of men sat drinking beer. I got out of the car and explained I wanted to find Julia Sanks, because she had known a musician who had introduced Negro music to Europe. "Is that a fact?" one of the men grinned. There followed a heated argument between them on how to give me the best directions. "You got to remember she's real old. She won't answer the door, most likely, but you keep knocking. She's there. You'll know you found it when you come to her hog pens. They empty now. She got just chickens. Be sure you don't go into the cemetery. That's too far. It's the second house on the right when you turn into Evergreen at the mailboxes. You have any trouble, you come back here and one of us'll go with you." When I found Julia Sanks's house, it was a three-room hovel. The rickety floorboards of its porch were falling in. A frost-brown date palm shaded a weedy dooryard. There was a creaking gate of splintery wood and barbed wire. Behind the pens, the leaves of pines and pecans quivered in the wind. I knocked and got no answer. But she was there, the men had said. Again I knocked. Finally I called out, "Mrs. Sanks, I've come to talk to you about Frederick Delius." "Come in," the old voice wheezed at last. "Come in then, hun." In her dim little front room, the smell of rotten food and of chicken litter from the pens was overpowering. Helplessly she sat in front of a fireplace full of unswept ashes. Ragged yellow curtains hung at the single window, its empty panes stuffed with old newspapers. Dirty filling was oozing out of an ancient velour sofa and also from the arms of her chair. Everything was stale, moldy, broken down, forgotten. On a makeshift shelf above the fireplace, I saw a large Bible, closed, with tarnished brass locks. "I can't move none," she explained. "It's the aches. Folks has come to cook supper and get eggs. Sometimes the welfare come, too. They say they get me glasses so I can see again, but I don't get 'em yet. I guess I'm some between 90 and 100. I don't rightly know when I was born. Sanks, he died a long time ago." Her face was broad and reddish-brown, deeply furrowed. Probably she had Spanish or Indian blood. Her nose was hawk-like. The heavy shapelessness of her body was wrapped in mended calico. "You got to give me time to recollect myself now, hun. Nobody asked me about those times any more." So in silence and in the stunning reality of her poverty, we waited. Sometimes her hands strayed to her wispy white hair. Sometimes her skirts brushed the torn linoleum of the floor as she tried to shift her bulk. Her breathing grew heavier. First she had lowered her head. Then she looked up at me, unseeing. "The Bible say, honor thy father and thy mother." Her voice fairly boomed with the announcement. What, I wondered, disappointed, did that have to do with Solano Grove? "Honor thy father and thy mother. That's what the good book tell." More quietly, "I could read it some once. But it say, too, rebuke not the chirin." "You rebuke your chirin, then you rebuke 'em right into looseness and sin. They do it to be contrary. And that boy, Mr. Delius, he have a daddy who rebuke him all the time. He could have made gospel hymns, but his daddy rebuke him into loose music. Time and time I tell Mr. Delius he ought to go to the church. I don't care which, because the Lord, he don't know denomination, just like he don't know color. But Mr. Delius, he pay no mind. He tinkered with that piano, especially when he come back. I disremember when. I was nothing but a child, hardly, when we sing to him first, Elbert and Eliza and me. Oh, we loved to go there. It was a happy place." "Was he hard to work for?" I asked, remembering I'd read that in Grez his face could turn to stone if his soup hadn't been properly salted. "Why, bress you, no, hon. He was never hard. Of course, he cooked for hisself most times. He want to. But he eat what I make.
Grits and black-eyed peas and side meat?"
"Sure, all them things. But he do for hisself mostly, like I say. I read up the house. Maybe he don't care what he eat if he can be at his piano or his fiddle. Long as he make his music, he just don't mind what else. He didn't have no conveniences. He didn't care about the fruits, neither. He didn't do any yard work to speak of. It was a trouble to Elbert and a worry. He weren't much for hard work, Mr. Delius, and that's a fact. Just that music. I ain't heard nothing like it since. I disremember what I sang to him except the hymns. You know, 'No Trouble in That Land Where I'm Bound,' and 'Jesus is Coming Again.' It was Elbert mostly he wanted to hear." The soft rain was splattering on the tar-paper roof overhead. I heard occasional drops falling into a tin pail in another room. Her bedroom, she said. Somebody had at least done that for her, kept her cot dry for her to sleep through the stifling nights of the rainy season. Oh, but people is good to me. You have no idea. I got cheering in Detroit and some down south working in the groves. The preacher, he come and read the scripture. The Lord, he's my shepherd. I don't want for nothing, hardly, because I got my blessed Jesus. Mr. Delius, I try to make him believe. You got to believe to be saved. Death is the gates of endless joy. I tell him that, but he just laugh. We got to pray for him now, hon, because he's such an unbeliever. If the comedy was high, the tragedy was higher. And so we begged a primitive Baptist Jesus to forgive one of his doubting sons all his sins. I heard a scuttling, a rat perhaps, across the floor of the back room hidden behind us in the gathering darkness. When we had finished, tears were streaming down Julia Sanx's sagging cheeks. Death is the gates of endless joy, and I coming to 'em now. And bress you, hun, to think of the happy times, and come to find old Julia and remember 'em with her. Soon I going to sleep in the mercy of the Lord. The trumpet going to sound, and I ready to hear. The doctor, he say dying folks out of their head when they hear the angels sing. But what they hear is joy. It was an echo, if remote, that seemed familiar. Then I remembered the final challenge of Frederick Delius, who had once written, "Independence and self-reliance are the marks of a man who is great and free. He will look forward to his death with high courage in his soul, in proud solitude, in harmony with nature and the ever-recurrent sonorous rhythms of birth and death." Always he had remembered the revelations of Florida. Sightless and hopelessly crippled, struggling in pain to dictate his last music with the will and ferocity of a lion, he had been too much of a mystic not to reach beyond his own atheism. In the strong choruses of songs of farewell, he had flung out his valediction to earth in the ringing words of American Walt Whitman. "Joy, shipmate, joy, please to my soul at death I cry. Our life is closed, our life begins, the long, long anchorage we leave. The ship is clear at last, she leaps, she swiftly courses from the shore. Joy, shipmate, joy."
The Other Florida, A Personal Impression of an Unknown Country, written and read by Gloria Jehoda. The Other Florida has been published by Charles Scribner's Sons and is presented for radio with their permission. These programs are produced by WFSU-FM at the Florida State University in Tallahassee.